In November 1999, members of the World Trade Organization convened in Seattle to negotiate trade agreements for the new millennium. But their talks quickly were overwhelmed by some 40,000 protesters who filled the streets, condemning globalization, corporate power, and the potential impacts of free trade on human rights and the environment.
And we are not afraid!
I'm Knute Berger, Crosscut's editor-at-large. I was in Seattle then. I covered the protests on the streets.
Firing tear gas and spraying pepper spray at us.
I remember what a big deal it was, the so-called battle in Seattle.
The bank window here at US Bank. We gotta get out of here.
The anarchists were a tiny fraction of the thousands who marched on Seattle, but they were a catalyst.
The whole world is watching! The whole world is watching!
Not only a fight for one day or 2 days, the fight for many years.
On November 19th, I'll moderate a conversation with some of the people at the center of the action in 1999. Including John Sellers, co-founder of The Other 98% and board president of the Ruckus Society, and Norm Stamper, Seattle's police chief at the time. Looking back 20 years later, we'll discuss what the battle in Seattle can teach us about who we are, where we've been, and where we're going. Please join us.
For more information about this event, go to crosscut.com/events.
Okay, on with the show.
Hello and welcome to Crosscut Talks, a podcast replay of Crosscut's live interviews with the people who shape our world. I'm Mark Bumgarten, the managing editor at Crosscut. Climate change is impacting our planet, but it's also impacting us. Our emotions, our psychology, and our worldview. And now, it's a concept that artists and curators are tackling too. The art they create and select helps translate and explore some of these impacts, and underscores the connection between art and the environment. Crosscut invited four artists and curators to discuss the work they do and the role they play in a climate-changing world. Ryan Feddersen is a mixed media installation artist who specializes in interactive and immersive work. She is a member of the Confederated Tribes of the Colville Reservation and often uses her work to honor an indigenous perspective and the relationship between artist and community. Barbara Matilski is an art historian and curator who creates exhibitions that address the intersection of art and natural science. Among other projects, she curated Vanishing Ice, Alpine and Polar Landscapes and Art, 1775 to 2012. That was an international traveling exhibition that examined the art history of glaciers within the context of climate change. Judy Tweet is a climate data sound artist and a doctoral candidate at the University of Washington. She uses sound and music to create acoustic and emotionally expressive representations of climate data. Her work has aired on NPR and PBS, and she has won 2 University of Washington awards for environmental leadership. Chris Jordan is an award-winning artist whose work explores contemporary mass culture from a variety of photographic and conceptual perspectives. His work has been shown all over the world. A recent series included a portrait built from 78,000 plastic water bottles. Crosscut Arts and Culture editor Brandon Davis moderated the discussion. During the panel, we displayed some of the artist's work. If you'd like to see it, go to crosscut.com/talks and click on the episode page. This conversation is sponsored by Comcast and the Nature Conservancy. It was recorded on May 4th, 2019 at Seattle University as part of the Crosscut Festival.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for coming to the Arts and Environment panel here. Slide right in. Excellent. So I'm going to have these guys introduce themselves in a minute. First, I just sort of wanted to start us off by saying, as a longtime arts writer in Seattle, I have started to see artists as translators. and translating for us beauty and ugliness and internal states and external realities. And so obviously artists have been translating the environment since the cave paintings, right? So, but it feels like with more and more dire news about the environment, and it feels like there's more and more artistic work being done about the environment. I don't know if that's true. You guys can challenge me on that. But as an arts writer, I feel like I'm writing more and more about artists who are doing work that reflects these concerns. So as you guys go through, I think we'll start with Barbara. Tell us a little bit about your work and how you sort of, what language, quote unquote, are you using as a translator for us?
Well, as a curator, I'm using art as a means to raise consciousness and to show that there's a rich cultural legacy of artists who have been working with scientists on their own, and that there is a... Well, let me just back up. I have been, for 30 years, figuring out a way to communicate the connection between art and the environment and artists and the environment. And that has led me to realize that, as you say, since cave painting, artists have been fundamental in creating a balance between art and the environment and between people and nature. And so this informed my first exhibition, which was in 1992, called Fragile Ecologies, Contemporary Artists' Interpretations and Solutions, which introduced the idea of ecological art, where artists actually went out and continued to go out into the community and work with scientists and environmentalists and community members to revive habitat. That notion, it traveled internationally, and then in the 2000s, I realized that climate change was becoming a very important issue. And so many artists were also traveling to the Arctic and Antarctica, and so I reached back to my doctoral dissertation, which was on 19th century alpine and polar landscapes in art, and realized that, again, artists were the messengers. They were, in the early times, showing how, showing the public new geographies, but also Ice Age and the history of the Earth. And then with contemporary artists, they are going out and talking about climate change. And so there are similarities and differences that were really important. And if you're interested in that exhibition, which was Vanishing Ice, Alpine and Polar Landscapes and Art, there's a website about that. And that exhibition opened in 2013 and traveled around the country and into Canada. And then most recently, I've worked on an exhibition that was at the Watka Museum called Endangered Species, because artists on the front line of biodiversity, because I think biodiversity is at as much at risk as we are for climate. And so even the accelerated pace of the loss of habitat is really key. So through these major exhibitions, I'm able to tell a story. And all of these artists here, I'm sure, have great stories to tell us.
Thanks. Ryan, you want to go next? And while you're talking, we're going to try to pull up a couple of images of some of your work. So you guys, if you haven't seen Ryan Feddersen's work, you're going to want to. So,
hi, welcome. I'm a Tacoma-based artist. I'm primarily a visual artist. I specialize in interactive and installation works. I was inspired by an Indigenous perspective on the relationship between artist and community, and opposed to making focusing on object making, I make a lot of things that are experiential, intended to create dialogue through community interaction. I'm really interested in the way that action can be used with metaphor to communicate content. I use it in a lot of different methodologies throughout my work and with a lot of different subjects, but usually with a focus on social activism. Some of the ways that my work has tied in, especially with themes around climate change and environmental responsibility, is through a series I work on called Coyote Now. I was reading through Mourning Dove's Coyote Stories. And Mourning Dove was a authoress in the 1920s who was descended from the Okanagan and Arrow Lakes bands, of which I'm also descended. And she translated our oral stories about coyote into an anthology and talked about the way in which stories could be retold in your time to continue their content. And so I created a series with the idea that Coyote is a continuously active figure and that he is impacting our world in different ways. And so I use Coyote as a lens to talk about the ways the mistakes we're making. As a trickster figure, he gets into a lot of trouble, he does the wrong thing, and he demonstrates lessons for us to see, like, oh, I don't want to be like Coyote, I'm going to do this better. And so I've used Coyote to talk a lot about climate change and the ways that we feel benefit from it, some of the things immediately, but then have these long-term negative consequences. And it kind of fits in with my general scope of work, which is using humor, play, storytelling, and metaphor to invite people to think deeper on subjects, to have opportunities for epiphany, and to have a little more introspection and as a way to make better choices.
Great, thank you. Oh, and there's a picture of one of your coyote installations up there.
Yeah, so the coyote installations are typically large coloring installations. They're kind of like a graphic novel. This one in this piece is about 72 feet long and 10 feet high. And then the audience colors them in with coyote's bones, which are the vehicle of his immortality. Sweat Lodge, knowing that Coyote would get himself into a lot of trouble, which would often cost him his life, said that if any scrap of fur, bone, or whisker remained, that Coyote could be brought back to life. And so the metaphor is that creativity is this vehicle of immortality. And as long as we continue to create with Coyote, we can keep his lessons immortal. And so that's one of the executions of that project.
Great, thanks. Judy.
Thank you. It's great to see you all here today. So I came to climate art by way of science, but I'm going to back up a little bit and say my relationship to this place is as a fifth generation Washingtonian, and my great 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 grandparents were settlers on the Kitsap Peninsula and loggers and farmers, and I grew up in a musical family. And I came to the University of Washington to study climate change as an atmospheric scientist, running models with supercomputers. One of the motivations for me was of studying climate change was loving this place and knowing that it was changing and that it was connected to this bigger systemic problem, and I wanted to know a lot more about it. And I also really liked physics and studying waves. But I taught my first class on global warming to a large lecture group of undergraduates at the University of Washington in 2013. And this was a class for non-majors, people who just wanted to understand the science. They were going to go off into all sorts of different fields. And we flooded them with data. We have so much evidence. There's no shortage of it. And yet I realized that there was too much. They were overwhelmed by it. We'd show slide after slide. Sometimes they start to just look identical. It's hard to tell them apart. It goes too fast sometimes. And there wasn't any space for processing it, for acknowledging the kind of how we might relate to the science as people who care so much about this planet. So that was sort of my experience of like, oh man, I really want to do the science better, and I think art can do that. So lots of people ask me, where'd you get this idea? I don't actually know. I mean, I do have a musical background, a musical family, but decided to take data sets and turn them, instead of taking the data and plotting it on a chart, turning it into a soundtrack. And for a couple reasons, climate change is something that happens over time. So if we look at data just as a graph that doesn't change, it loses that sense of this evolution of things getting warmer over time, of ice melting over time. So music can create an experience of that change that can bring people together, and that can help to slow down and open up for some sort of emotional connection to the science of climate change. So that's my little bit about my background.
And we have, I think, a couple of short clips of some of the translated. Yeah.
Sure, and let me just say a little bit. I don't want to just play it because it's like looking at a data set without the axes labeled. So if we can play the sea ice piece, what you're going to listen to is a piece that's taken the satellite record of Arctic sea ice, and we can view the area of ice over the Arctic Ocean. And each month is the sort of how much the ice was above or below its average. So if you hear higher notes, that means there was more ice that month. And if you hear lower notes, it means there was less ice that month. And this is mapped to the piano keyboard. So if you were watching it visually, you would see that the hand is moving down the keyboard. And then there's one other thing, that there's a lot of rhythm in climate data because we have seasons. So there's a seasonal cycle in there. And so you'll hear that as well.
Low notes are not good, but beautiful. Do you know that around the period when the hands cross and starts going lower?
Yeah, so that started in 1979, and then 2002 there was actually a key change to signify when some months of the year were sort of statistical anomalies. And actually the lowest ice on record was September of 2012, but then 2015 was another low year, and it's entered a new regime. It's very low. This has huge impacts for Arctic communities in particular, who depend on the ice to hunt, to travel, for the ecosystems. So we often think of the polar bear as the iconic species of the Arctic, and yet it has major impacts on communities, human communities as well.
Thank you. Okay, and Chris Jordan, let's hear about your work.
Hi, you guys. I'm a photographer and I guess a filmmaker now. I just recently completed an 8-year project on Midway Island in the very middle of the Pacific Ocean, photographing birds whose bodies are filled with plastic. If you've seen those, I'm that guy. And it began as a witnessing of a tragedy. And the reason I went there was because I was only interested in the plastic inside their stomachs as kind of a commentary on mass consumption and humanity's broken relationship with the living world. And as I returned to the island multiple times, a total of 8 times over several years, I fell in love with the live birds, the live albatrosses, these magnificent beings that are as big as eagles. There are a million of them on this tiny island that's not even the size of this campus. And they've lived for 4 million years on this island, and they've never had a predator. And so they have no fear of humans. So imagine walking out into a field where they're as thick as we are in this room on the ground, hundreds of thousands of them, and they don't run away and fly away the way creatures do almost everywhere else on Earth. In fact, if you walk out and sit down, you see them looking like, what's that thing over there? And then they start doing this greeting motion and they come toward us, and pretty soon you're surrounded by them. And you can film them in an incredibly intimate close-up range, their babies hatching from their eggs and doing their magnificent, graceful, elegant mating dance. And so my project sort of morphed from a horror story into a love story, and that's what my film is. It's called Albatross. It's available for free on the internet if you want to watch it.
Great. That those photos, if you go to, it's chrisjordan.com, right? There are a lot more. And what's striking to me is, of course, the gut punch of how sad they are, but also how beautiful they are. And I think that was one of the things that is sort of a thread is, you know, this finding there's something beautiful about this horrific images and facts and stats. That's beautiful music. These colors. If you haven't been to the Henry Gallery right now, there's a great environmental artist who's got a big show there, Cecilia Vicuña, from Chile, and all of her work is made of beach garbage, and it's, you know, it's garbage, but it's so colorful and beautiful, and, you know, and striking. And then your work, the earlier images we had of the piece is called Black Snake Rising, right? And obviously it's about oil, and but it's these beautiful, I mean, it's beautiful. So as artists, I'm wondering about that, that part of, it's almost like a strategy. I never think of artists like, you know, having a strategy for their work, but a way of bringing people in. Do you think about that, the beauty of it? Talk about that.
Well, I can say as a curator that one of the things that I'm always searching for is the beauty, because that is what's going to capture people's attention. Once you have them there, then the ideas and the stories can unfold, the relationship to natural history. But it's the beauty to which we all respond as humans from the earliest times. And so that's critical. There's a story that I like to relate of a class that came to the Vanishing Ice exhibition in 2013 from Western Washington University. And the professor said to me in front of his class, well, how come you talking so much about beauty in your work and in the show? And I said, he said, it's so regressive, you know, it's so retardataire. And I said, well, that's the way you're going to really be able to grab people. That's the strategy. And there's nothing wrong with it. And so we have to get over that postmodern notion that beauty has no place in our culture, because, I mean, that's what's going to connect us, and that's what's going to inform our way as we move forward to making this connection between art and the environment.
Thank you. Anybody else want to speak to that?
Well, just in response to what you said, oh my God, that's the most unbelievably ridiculous thing for somebody to say. Beauty has no place in our culture. Like, I mean, to me, if you made a Venn diagram in a circle, if you put all of the bad news in the entire world, all of the environmental destruction, all of the social injustice, like everything, and all of the feelings that go with it, horror and disempowerment and hopelessness and pain, all of it in a circle, in every moment of our existence, in every single instant, that circle is contained in a circle of incomprehensibly incredible beauty. And the magnificent, I mean, right outside the window, those trees, like knowing what we know about the way, what's going on inside a single leaf on the cellular and the molecular on the quantum level, like a single leaf is a miracle absolutely beyond comprehension. And that's the thing. It's like the beauty of our world is so obvious that that's the thing we forgot. And And even some people think it's irrelevant, and it's just like not even on their radar is something that exists. And to reconnect with beauty, if we could collectively reconnect with beauty, I believe then we would be home again, or maybe for the first time, and then everything could change.
And Barbara, you also mentioned grabbing people. So that was another thing I wanted to talk about is like, do you feel a responsibility as artists to grab people? Is the primary objective to educate, inform, enlighten, or is it a spur to action? Like, do you feel like you want people to act because they see your work? Is that the most important thing, or is it more about mind expansion first?
Oh, yes. Go ahead.
Anybody?
Yeah. So, I definitely want people to act, and yet I think I'm becoming worried because we often now are associating climate change with extreme episodic events, and there's nothing wrong with that, right? It is causing more wildfires and heat waves and droughts and a coastal erosion. Yet those are the symptoms of it. So if we're not able to sort of think about it as this slower, longer-term systemic change in the planetary system, then I don't think we're able to act as thoughtfully as we need to. So how do we help people to sort of step back and see a bigger picture? I think beauty comes in here, actually, in some senses, in that it's a way of keeping cynicism in check. When we're reaching towards beauty, there's a connection between that and goodness. But we also have to sort of lift ourselves up when we're thinking about climate change and take the bird's eye view. We started to do that in the 70s when we saw the first complete image of Earth from space. We're just beginning to, as a species, of developing this planetary consciousness. So, there's political art, there's apolitical art. I think all of it has different uses and purposes for people. One of my goals is just to allow sort of space for a little bit more reflection for people to sort of not feel extremely agitated in the moment when they're thinking about climate change, but to understand it as a systemic change and something that we can't fully grasp in our own individual experiences. We do have to think about it as something that is abstract, even though it will affect us in our own lives and our places where we live and love.
And Ryan, your work immediately prompts people to act. So can you talk about how you hope that carries through longer, or do you not worry about it too much after the exhibit?
Well, I think that there is, one of the reasons that why I do art and why I came to art was this idea that I wanted to communicate and I wanted to educate, and I also wanted to encourage introspection and to give people space to think about things in a way that would allow them to perhaps make other choices. And so I see both beauty and play as kind of an exchange. And that I definitely started out with work that was much more confrontational and much more provocative or shocking, but I don't think that that's the way you win an argument very often. And I think that we're very much taught to approach things differently. And as soon as you put someone back on their heels, you've already lost so much ground on having any productive conversation. And so I try and make spaces where people can think in depth about these subjects, and often where their action is metaphorically playing out the content that I want them to be gathering from it. But my goal is to initiate that conversation and dialogue. And a lot of times in these interactive ways, that ends up being people who explain it to each other who they're with. So it starts all these conversations between intergenerational conversations and them trying to explain how this piece is functioning. And for me, that's a lot of the goal. I try and look at what is the most important priority. Sometimes
just awareness is enough, because if you don't have awareness, you can't talk about the next things. You get stuck there because they're like, what on earth is that? And so I try and think about like what the audience is, what knowledge they're coming in with, whether or not this is the situation is to just get more people talking and thinking about it, or whether there are specific action solutions that could be suggested by it or reflected in the action in the piece. And I kind of approach that differently on what the specific content and opportunities are.
And Chris, we were talking backstage. Did you want to share what you were saying just about whether you expect people to act after seeing your work or not?
Yeah, it's, you know, to me, that's really kind of the core of being, I mean, I don't even think of myself as an environmental artist, but being like being in that category, my model is Picasso. And if you went to Picasso and said, I just saw your painting Guernica on the Reina Sofia, in the Reina Sofia Museum, what should I do? Like, you can see how ridiculous it is for artists to tell anybody. Picasso would probably punch you in the nose. And I think what he would say is, I'm not here to tell anybody how to behave. That's not my role in the world. I'm just here to show you how much I care. And in the case of that painting, it was how much he cared about the little town of Guernica that was bombed out of existence by the fascists. And that's kind of, he's my role model that way. And my belief is, like, if I can go to an island like Midway and not just take kind of superficial snapshots, but really, really spend time with these dead birds and be with them as they're dying and witness them with reverence, then, and produce something that just says, here's how much I care, here's what I felt when I had that experience. If I can do that with enough integrity and clarity, then I will tap into something universal, because I believe we all care. I didn't know when I went to Midway Island, I had no idea how much I was in love with albatrosses. And it didn't feel like something that happened to me. It felt like something was already there, built inside of me that I just was unaware of, that was revealed to me. So I believe we're all in love with albatrosses. We're all in love with all beings. It's our fundamental state of being, is to be in love with the miracle that we're all a part of. And if I can find that in my own self and simply express that, then it taps into something universal. Like, that's my hope. And in that space, then I'm not here to tell anybody how to behave. Like, I trust that everybody will go do the right thing or the wrong thing or whatever. But if we can become more connected with our essence, then things will move in the right direction.
I think how I interpret what Chris is talking about is how art becomes a spiritual connection to people. And we haven't talked about spirituality, but I think the beauty and spirituality are really connected. And as a curator, I do select work that is going to get people to feel a sense of transcendence. And the activism part comes in because through text panels, which is how I can convey information and interpret, people are hungry to understand and to figure out how they can act, you know, what they could do. And I can't tell you how many times, you know, I'll talk to docents and they'll say, you know, your text panel that said, you know, things that you can do to make a difference. So for my endangered species exhibition, I had introductions to different problems that are causing habitat loss and, you know, all these phenomena that's causing a loss of biodiversity. And in each section, it was what you can do. And it was really just suggestions, how you can connect and what people are doing to give people a hope. And so for me, when I hear docents say, you know, people are really happy to have that information because they want to know. And it might sound corny because it feels very obvious that if you want to do something, you can figure it out. But for a lot of people, there aren't as many avenues, or they don't think about the avenues. And so as a curator, I really feel it's important to list them in panels, not didactically, but just saying, you know, here's what you can do. And so that's, you know, that's just a strategy for getting people to care.
You're saying, mentioning the spirituality reminded me of, there's a Seattle artist named Margie Livingston. Anybody familiar with her? Yeah. And she does this, right now she's doing this extreme painting project where she's fashioned herself a harness and she attaches a canvas to the harness on a leash and then just walks around different environments, and then the painting is what was picked up on the canvas. And they're really amazing. And she has some short films of her doing it. And then there is some kind of a penitent thing. There's like a kind of a hair shirty feel of what she's doing. But there's also humor. And Ryan, you mentioned the sort of playfulness. You know, Margie is very aware that what she's doing looks a little bit absurd. And so these different ways of different entry points, I guess, for people are you know, essential to both getting people's attention and making the actual art come alive, right?
I think there's another element of it as well, because one of the things I use play to do is, for example, I've done works where people have stayed in them for 2 hours. People look at paintings, on average, I think they say like 20 seconds. And so I get a lot more investment in time when I give people something creative to do. But the other reason I do that is not just the amount of time spent with a subject, it's what your mind is doing when you're being creative, because it's not a passive experience. And I think that it is a mindset that is much more conducive to discovery, to change, to introspection, to get people already in that space of like being creative. And I think play gives people the opportunity to maybe experience new ideas and feelings about a subject while not necessarily feeling threatened. And that's a good way to help people process through things.
Mm-hmm. One more thing we were talking about backstage is just sort of in the face of these incredible stats, this wealth of information coming at us, very dark information about the environment, and some of the previous work of yours, Chris, where you're showing these enormous numbers of, old cell phones, and some of the other pictures, definitely go to his website. It feels overwhelming, and some of us kind of shut down because it's too much. It's too much to believe. So thinking about where is the hope in that? And I apparently, if I was not able to go, but the Apocalypse Now panel earlier, which did not sound particularly hopeful to me, was apparently had a lot of hope. But in art, where are you guys finding hope for the future of humanity? Just a small question.
I really like what you said about getting people to be playful and creative and engaging in art. I think that, it's gotten cut out of our schools, unfortunately. Like, we don't have enough time to be artful. If you're not an artist, to be creative, maybe together or on your own. But that is so often the place where we're willing to sort of try new things, to make changes in our lives, and to experiment with solutions. And so I think that I've found that art can, when I'm giving a science talk and then I bring music into it, you know, sometimes people will say, oh, thank God, I thought I was going to be too overwhelmed, or I thought this was going to feel too political, which also makes me sad that they think a science talk will be political. Regardless, I think it can help to open up this space where we can see new possibilities and we can start to imagine things, or at least allow us to start to do that. Because when we shut down, when we feel overwhelmed, it's because we think there's a foregone conclusion and there's nothing for us to do. So one of the reasons I wanted to bring music into the way of, you know, telling data, expressing data, is to just open up new channels and to start thinking about it a little differently, to be playful, like you said.
This is a little bit of a silly analogy, but so attitude, like the attitude of a plane, where the wings are level and it's pointing forward. This is something that comes from some like leadership jargony speak, but forgive me for using it a little bit. But anyway, so your attitude is what you point towards. And so sometimes you're pointing away from things, but then where you're pointing towards doesn't have a direction. And so there's a lot of these dystopic futures that you see in fiction and in a lot of depictions, but how do we avoid, if we're just trying to avoid that, where are we steering the ship? And so I think there's a lot of room in creativity for imagining better futures, for envisioning better solutions
And whether that comes from personal action or from large social change regionally or globally in order to do that. But we need to start pointing somewhere positive that we want to be instead of just being like, oh my God, we got to get away from where we're going.
Barbara, did you want to?
I think that the conversation has to shift, not necessarily in this panel, but in the wider world. And that is we need to recognize that we all have the potential to be artists. And the way I translate artist is creative problem solving. And the more people who can think about what they do from that lens, the better off we'll be, because there's so much that needs to be done in our culture and our society to move forward, to change in a positive direction, that we need everybody, not just the artists, obviously, but the idea of creativity has to filter through everything that we do as much as possible all the time. And that's why I think that maybe the idea about art needs to be broadened, and the artist could be called creatives, and we're all creatives in what we do. Or have the potential to be, that is.
And before we move to the Q&A, did you want to share where you just got back from? And that sounded very hopeful, your recent adventure.
I've just been in the desert Southwest for 2 months. In Utah and Nevada on a long photographing, vision questing sojourn. And you know, I do a lot of thinking about hope. I think hope is such an interesting phenomenon in our culture. It's like, it's this thing that everybody, like collectively, we feel like we have to have hope as a prerequisite before we act. And even we have to have hope to keep on living. Like, if we're hopeless, then everything's out the window. So it's like, it's this really important thing in our collective story. And if you look at what actually is hope, it's not a feeling, it's a mind state, it's a set of thoughts. And one thing you can say about hope is that it's not in the present moment. Hope is grounded in the future. It's like some sort of optimism as opposed to pessimism, that things can be better or we can make them better. It's something in the future. And the other thing you can say about it is that it's not an active state of mind, it's a passive state of mind. We don't hope for what we can control. We hope for what is out of our control. So my friend Terry Tempest Williams says, hope is for hostages. When you got the bag over your head and the guy's with his machete, you hope he doesn't cut your head off. Or my son likes to make a joke about hope. He comes home from school and says, I hope I do my homework tonight. It's like, we don't hope for what we can control. So hope is fundamentally passive and is fundamentally not grounded in the present. And I think the whole notion of hope is actually a linguistic mistake that we're making. There's this feeling that we want, and we call it hope, but it's this vague thing, and it's a little bit like God. Like if you ask 50 people what is God, you get 50 complete different answers. And if you ask 50 people what is hope, you get 50 complete different answers. It's like this sort of puff of smoke, but there's this thing that we all want to have. And what I think is we just chose the wrong word. The thing that we all want to have is not hope, it's love. Love is something now. It doesn't matter if everything's going to hell, we can still behave with love. We can still feel love in the present moment. And it's not passive, it's active. It's the most powerfully motivating feeling. So I think we should do what in Dante's Inferno, when he walked through the gates, abandon hope, all ye who enter here. That's not abandon hope in favor of hopelessness. My teacher, Joanna Macy, says, hope and hopelessness live together at one end of a continuum. They're both disempowered, passive mind states. The opposite of hope is not hopelessness. The opposite of hope is action. So when Dante walks through that gate and abandons hope, that's the moment he takes control of his destiny. So I say, let's let go of hope and make love the thing that we're all seeking and holding as we go forward.
Okay, I'm using this fancy little system here. Okay,
Not fancy enough for me to see it. Let's see. That's another technology. Okay. We use scientific language to talk about the environment. And sometimes that doesn't resonate. How about getting back to terms like Mother Nature? Any thoughts on that, guys? Is the environmental talk too scientific for people to connect with it?
Yeah, we're really good at jargon. but I think when you decide to use the more cultural terms, then it just depends on the audience. And some people are definitely going to connect with the metaphor of Earth as a mother. But some won't. Some will think that that's for people who don't identify with. And so I think it just depends on kind of your cultural affiliation more than anything. But I completely agree with whoever was asking the question that the language of scientists does not connect us in a deep way with what we love and care about. It is, it's technical and it's objective.
Can I just interject? In the 70s, James Lovelock coined the term Gaia, and that was in relationship to Mother Nature. But at the same time, it also talked about and shed light on the fact that the Earth is a living organism, and we know now that that's true. The rainforests breathe oxygen and absorbs carbon dioxide. It's a pulsing entity. And so I think that you can have both the science, if it's done right, and the more comforting thoughts about Mother Nature as just an example. So the two can go side by side, go hand in hand.
Mm-hmm. Uh-oh, I lost my screen. But I memorized the next question, which is, do you guys know of any theatrical approaches to environmental art in your experience? Have you seen, we talked about Margie Livingston, who's definitely has an aspect of theatricality to her work. Any more performative? I know there are a lot of dancers, even in town. Can you help me? Karen Stevens Dance is doing she's doing a part of the worldwide, there's a global water dance happening in June, and where everyone can participate in celebrating water and our watery planet. So dance is all over it. Any other performative arts doing environmental work?
I saw a performance last summer by a group called Nomads, which are out of Vancouver, and they perform on a ship. And this ship was harbored in Bellingham. And you sit on the grass, and there's a projection and the story of climate change through the lens of butterflies is projected on this boat. And it's quite astonishing. So that's an amazing opportunity to use all of the senses in a performative way. And if anybody's interested in that, go to the website and look up Nomad out of Vancouver and you'll learn about it.
And one other, there's a Canadian playwright, Chantal Bilodeau, who's done plays on Arctic climate change called The Arctic Cycle. So you can check those out as well. I'll be doing a workshop with her in a couple weeks.
Oh, cool. Excellent.
Erica Lord does some great performances where she hunts polar bears inside zoos.
Tell us more.
she dresses in the traditional regalia of her tribe and goes through the fountains and attempts to find food to hunt, and then interacts with patrons who are experiencing the zoo.
Wow. Say her name again.
Erica Lord.
Lord, okay.
There's another artist. Her last name is escaping me, but she, so I hear, is the second most followed person on Twitter and Instagram from Alaska. Her name is Allison. and she is a, she's also an Indigenous performance artist. She does a lot of sculpture. She creates traditional diving suits. And she raps on behalf of endangered species. So you just put Allison Rapper Alaska. She'll probably come
great.
Up.
I'm going to do that right after this.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Oh, good. Okay. I think we're pretty much out of time. We have one more question, and which one am I going to pick? I think the most important one is how can we contact you after this to learn more about your work? So you guys all have, I know you guys all have websites that are your first and last name there. So look on your schedule, firstandlastnames.com, right? All.com. And then Barbara, do you have a way of people getting in touch with you? Do you have an upcoming show you're working on?
You can reach me at bmatilski@comcast.net, but also you can check out vanishingice.org and learn more about this very important topic through the lens of climate change.
Great. And Chris?
And my film, Albatross, I gave it as a gift to the world, so it's available for free on our website, which is just albatrossthefilm.com. You can download it and own it or stream it for free, so I hope you guys get to watch it.
Hope.
And I'm currently working on a new rendition of Coyote Now, which will be at the Ocean Fest, which is a ecological activism event in Tacoma at the Foss Waterway on June 9th. And so I'll be looking at some traditional stories of coyote, fox, and whale with kind of some new twists.
And Judy, did you want to mention your new music piece you're working on?
Yeah, so it's not out yet. This summer I'll be completing a collection of pieces about Arctic climate change, similar to what you heard, although I'll be adding recordings from field recordings from the Arctic, as well as weaving together Native Alaskan stories of their own direct experience of climate change in Alaska. So that'll be coming out in the fall.
Terrific. Thank you guys so much for joining us.
Thanks for coming.
Thanks for listening to Crosscut Talks. This week's episode was recorded by Resty Bacall and produced by Sarah Bernard. Audio from the Crosscut Festival was recorded by Seattle Theater Group. You can subscribe to Crosscut Talks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. For more on the Crosscut Talks podcast, go to crosscut.com/talks. And if you like the show, please review us on Apple Podcasts. It really helps people find us. For the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, go to crosscut.com. And remember to save the date for the next Crosscut Festival, May 1st and 2nd, 2020. To learn more, go to crosscut.com/festival. Crosscut Talks is a product of Cascade Public Media. I'm Mark Bumgarten. We'll be back next week with another episode.